In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about how to make your first hire. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 285. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
You know, I'm pretty good. It's nice to be a week away from MicroConf and kind of get my feet back under me. It feels like, you know, we're done with Q1 of 2016 already and kind of heading into the mid-year. So I've been looking out, what's the next 90 days? What's the next 6 months looking like? And revisiting kind of the goals and the direction and the vision that I set out in my retreat, which was at the very beginning of January. And, you know, there was both some personal stuff and some work and drip-oriented growth stuff that I'm just kind of revisiting and figuring out, am I on track for those? Do I need to adjust them? Are we ahead of schedule or behind or whatever? So that's been kind of fun just to go back and review. I think that's important to do, whether you do it monthly or quarterly, is to like review those goals and figure out where you are with them. And with that in mind, we're trying to find new growth channels and starting to make some progress on a few fronts. Finally starting to get some little bit of traction with paid traffic, which has been something we've been working on and off for a while with Drip, and seems like we've kind of got our foot in the door with a couple avenues that I'm pretty excited about.
Very cool.
How about you?
Recently, I kind of did the same thing and kind of looked back over at quarterly progress, because as you said, it's the end of the quarter. So, and it's kind of, I look at that and say, oh, this, it almost sucks because like the last 3 months have just kind of flown by and it feels like my head is down almost the entire time. But at the same time, things are moving forwards. And I looked back at some of my annual goals for this year, and for revenue on Bluetick already, I'm up to like 17% of my goal. And it's obviously about 25% of the way through the year, but I also haven't really got the product out the door to anyone beyond the people who are doing pre-orders. The fact that I don't have the product out the door really, and I'm still at that point, it's not like I'm very far behind. It's really what it comes down to.
Right. It's not atypical. I mean, I think most of our goals are ambitious. Do you feel like your Bluetick goal was ambitious?
Oh, yeah. It was one of those big, fat, hairy, audacious goals.
Yeah. So it's like you don't want to shrug it off and be like, oh, well, I just missed it. I mean, I think now it's like, okay, how can I make up that 8% over the next month or two? You know, how can I get to the point where I am actually back on track?
Yeah, and I think that that'll come with actually launching the product publicly and getting it out there and making it available for people to sign up for. Because right now it's just based off of what's going to my mailing list and the little things that I'm doing there. But, you know, longer term, obviously, there's a lot that goes into it.
Yep, and that's the hard part, is when you're setting these goals, it's like sometimes they are shot in the dark, especially if you just have revenue goals, or if you have milestones of like getting a launch by this date, then it's a little more easy to quantify. But it's like, do you really know what your revenue is going to be until you're, you know, at a sustainable, repeatable process where you know how many trials are coming in, you know what your conversion rates are at that point, then you can kind of project it out. But before then, it is a bit more of a guessing game. And so I've always kind of taken it, if I'm ahead of my projected, then I figured I guessed too low. And if I'm behind it, then I'm trying to figure out how to get there without letting it destroy me, right? You can't let it beat you up or make you feel like a failure. It needs to be motivation rather than making you feel like you've dropped the ball.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that I'm only 8% behind a quarter of the way through the year and the product's just not out the door, I mean, that to me bodes really well, because I didn't expect to have it out there for, you know, kind of public consumption until about halfway through the year. And in some ways, I almost feel like I'm ahead. You could almost kind of fast forward to say, okay, well, that revenue goal was for the last 6 months of the year. But that said, I mean, right now we're going through and we're plugging away at trying to onboard people who've placed pre-orders. And I have to be honest, like some of the stuff that we're running into is just flat out embarrassing. The earliest thing that we tried to do when onboarding, like there was the sign-up itself was just completely fundamentally broken. I had to do some things on the fly to get somebody on there, and it's generally working at this point. And we're just trying to work through any of the UI and UX issues with people. So it's coming along, but it's obviously slower than I'd like. One of my developers is getting married on Monday, so he's kind of out of commission for at least like the next week or two.
Yeah, that's always a bummer when you're pushing hard and something comes up for anyone. Obviously, very important and worth doing, but it's tough. I think we're impatient as founders, you know, and we want to hit the goals. So what are we talking about this week?
Well, this week we're going to be talking about how to make your first hire. And this is a question that was asked by somebody inside of Founder Cafe, which we've mentioned Founder Cafe before. It's our online membership site. And the question was really geared towards how do you decide whether you need somebody for part-time or full-time And how do you approach those two different scenarios? Because obviously that's going to be dictated by what your revenue is and what your strengths and weaknesses are in both your skill set and in the business itself in terms of the revenue that's coming in.
Yeah. And in your early days, I mean, the advice I would give is like stay with part-time and contractors for as long as you possibly can. And there's no reason to jump to W2 employees until you absolutely need to, because it brings complexity, you know, and I think that's kind of, in our circles, that's probably pretty well known. But I think if you're in doubt, part-time contractors give you the flexibility of being able to only pay hourly and flex up and down as you need. There are some pros and cons to doing it that we'll get into in this episode, but that's probably a thought that I would start the episode with in terms of thinking about your first hire.
So to start off with, I know that we're going to talk about some of the differences and pros and cons for hiring part-time and full-time, but I think what we want to do first is to talk about some of the things that are applicable to both, because I think that there's definitely a lot of overlap between hiring for part-time versus hiring for full-time. So the first one is to look for self-starters who can dive in and are going to find ways to improve the business and the products that you're working on. And I think this is really important because you don't want to hire somebody who is going to come to you and every time they complete a task, they come back to you and say, what do you want me to work on next? Because then it turns you into more of a micromanager and it's very difficult to get away from that. I mean, there's going to be a little bit of that, I think, up front, because they're going to want to know what the general direction of the business is and the product and everything else. But you don't want to be in the position where every single time they finish something, you have to find something else for them to do. You really want them to be essentially generating their own tasks and having some sort of awareness of what your overreaching goals are, and then be able to just go do those things without you telling them, hey, you need to do X, Y, and Z.
Well, I think in an ideal world, you would do this, but I think in the early days when your budget is tight, it's hard to find people like this. I mean, these are the people that everybody wants. So I think that there is perhaps an approach you can take, even if you can't find self-starters, that can still work. And this is what I did in the early days, and a lot of people who are cash-strapped in the early days do, and it's to find people who are really good at a single skill and then slowly basically fire yourself from the jobs that you are doing. So the example that I often give is to hire that first tier one email support person. And they may not be that much of a self-starter. They may not figure out ways to improve stuff, but just getting that email support off your plate in the early days with someone who is good at that single skill, it can really be there's a focus lift, there's a time benefit, and it's a recurring task that happens every day or every week. So I think if you've never hired before and you've never even hired a contractor, that would probably be like the simplest little baby step that I would take. This actually brings me to a point I was going to bring up, which is that hiring is a learned skill. The more you do it, the better you get. And when you start, you're going to be pretty bad at it and you're going to have a bunch of missteps. I don't know anyone who goes out of the gate and hires really well the first time. And so like in the early days when I was first trying to figure out who to hire and what to hire for, it's like you want to look at your recurring tasks, the ones that are going to be relatively simple to outsource, and then you work your way up to the more complex tasks. And this is all based on your budget, right? Because the more budget you have, the better people in general you can hire. But in the early days, if you really are bootstrapping, then you kind of have to, you got to cobble it together and limp along for a while, even if you're not as efficient. And that's one of the reasons some people raise funding. You know, if you did raise an angel round of $250,000 or $500,000, it can make this part easier because then you do have the budget to hire better people from the start. But if you truly are bootstrapping, you want to self-fund this, that's okay too. Just know that you're going to have some limitations in the early days in terms of the quality and the effectiveness of people you can hire.
I think kind of a subtext to what you just said is that for something like support, it's time consuming, but doesn't necessarily add a huge amount of, I'll say, top line revenue value to the business. Like, it needs to be done, but it isn't necessarily you that needs to do it. And because it's time consuming, it's best to start with something like that for you to outsource.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And time consuming and like attention grabbing, you know, because that's what, like, email support is a bummer because it's interruptive and it's really hard to just batch that because you can't just do that once a week. And even doing it once a day is not ideal. In a perfect world, you would check every couple hours and take care of that stuff. And so I think there's a time and then there's that focus or attention element. And if you have recurring things that take time and attention, those are the first ones you want to look at essentially hiring for.
The next thing that's essentially applicable to both part-time and full-time hiring is that you should always be interviewing multiple candidates. Anytime I've gone through and hired somebody and whittled it down to just one or two people and then only interviewed one person, it seems to never work out. And I feel like that's because you don't necessarily have a good basis for comparison of kind of gauging that person's skills or abilities against the other people who obviously you haven't interviewed. So I think that's one of those recommendations that you kind of have to interview multiple candidates. And if you're at a point where you don't have multiple candidates, then that should be a red flag. Like you need to go find more, or there's something broken in your hiring process.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty rare. I think in all the hiring I've done over the years, there's probably been one or two hires where we knew the perfect person for the job. And it was someone we already knew or were acquainted with, right? And we knew that they'd be a fit and all that stuff. And so we didn't interview multiple candidates. But far and wide, I mean, the literally dozens of positions I've hired for, and it's probably including, you know, I used to be a development lead and a tech lead and a manager for some companies down in LA when I was still doing salaried work. It's got to be approaching like 100 people that I was involved in the hiring process of. And with all those, it's like you just have to get a lot of candidates through the door or at least on the phone. We used to do a lot of kind of phone screenings in advance. Nowadays, you just do it via Skype and you would never actually meet with people in person anyways. But interviewing multiple candidates is absolutely the way to go. And it's the only way you're going to get an idea of kind of the skill level and what's really available on the market at that time.
The next thing that's applicable to both is that a bad hire is orders of magnitude worse than no hire. So if you hire somebody who is not a good fit for either the position or for the, I'll say, company culture, and you can have like a company culture, even if it's just you and one other person. But in those situations, if you're not able to hire somebody, you're better off than if you make a mistake in hiring, because those early mistakes are so incredibly time consuming to deal with and difficult on the business, both in terms of revenue and time spent and opportunity lost.
Yeah. And the way that I used to combat this, I mean, I think over time I've gotten better naturally at hiring just because you do it more and you kind of get pickier and know what to look for. In the early days, I would recommend that when you hire those first few people that you do all the training via screencast and or in writing, because you want to have it repeatable. And we had multiple situations where we'd hire a VA to help with support and setup and this other stuff, and then that VA wouldn't work out. And sometimes it was them. They just flaked. Sometimes found out they didn't have the skills. And having to repeat the training, if you had just done it live on Skype or something, would be such a pain in the butt, right? It makes it really time consuming. So try to make your training as repeatable as possible, especially in the early days, because you're probably going to have to take a few swings at bat and get a few people through the door, get them trained up before you find that right fit. Another thing to keep in mind is that, you know, entry-level people are the least expensive and you can find some pretty good deals, but you have to spend the time to train them on the tasks. Experienced people who already know how to do something, let's say you're hiring for email support and they've already done it, or you're hiring to manage Facebook ads, or you're hiring to help handle integrations and help with stuff. Experienced people are a lot more expensive. I mean, if they actually have experience in what you're doing, they tend to be 2 times, 4 times more expensive for the same task, but they can hit the ground running. So very important to keep in mind, like, how much budget do I have? And realizing that trying to find a competent person at a highly sought after skill set is going to cost a lot of money. And so you have to think through at what level can you hire? And this is a reason, like in the early days when you're bootstrapping, you may need to invest more time because you don't have as much money. So you may need to work more hours in the early days to get this thing going. That doesn't mean you have to work the crazy 80-hour startup weeks forever. But if you're hiring people and you're having to train them from scratch, you're kind of putting in your sweat equity because you don't have the cash to put up. And so I see it as exchanging value there. And you have to weigh that out in your own mind.
I think the next thing you have to remember is that going from 0 to 1 employees is the hardest. And I think this is applicable whether you are a solo founder or whether you have co-founders. The fact of the matter is that you're bringing somebody else into the mix that is not familiar with your company or where it came from or the roots, or maybe not even the problem space itself, especially like if you're hiring a new developer and they don't know the problems that you have been working on and are intimately familiar with, they're going to have to learn some of those things. And they may know their job very well and they may be an expert in the things that they do, but they're not necessarily an expert in not just your systems themselves, but also how your business operates and what your customer base looks like.
The other thing to think about is as your budget grows, you can hire better people. So I do think that you should kind of stair step your way up as you're able to, because in general, when you have more money, you can hire better people, like I've already said. But the other thing that I've realized is that in the early days, as a founder, you're probably going to be the best at any given task because you don't have the budget to hire subject matter experts. So you're going to have to hire entry-level people. And so if you've learned Facebook ads, you're then going to have to train them. If you know how to do the email support, you're going to have to train them. At a certain point, that flips. And then you'll be able to hire people who are actually better than you at a given task. And that's when things, they get definitely get more expensive, but it becomes so much easier because you can go out and pay, you know, a Facebook ad consultant or someone who has experience doing this, or you can pay a professional senior developer who's been building and writing code for years and it is on par with you. And so I think that's ultimately, long-term, that's the ultimate goal. That's not your first hire, right? But think about that over the course of several years as your business grows, that you probably want to go from being able to train people and hire people who where you're the subject matter expert, but as soon as you can, get to the other one because it'll allow you to move faster.
So with those things in mind, let's kind of move on and talk a little bit about the differences between the part-time hires and full-time hires. And I think that generally speaking, as you said before, when you're looking to hire and you're first starting to do that in your business, you should probably start with a part-time person. And I think when you're doing that, if you're looking specifically at people who are doing contracting, that's probably the best place to start. I don't think that you want to go out and look for people who are currently working full-time and then just kind of picking up something on the side. And I think there's a big difference between those types of people versus people who are doing contracting full-time because they might only work for you for 10 hours a week or something like that, but they're used to that mode of working. They're experienced at working remotely. They're experienced at dealing with people over the phone or via Skype or Slack and email. And that's just their primary mode of operation versus those people who are in an office environment and that's what they're used to. That's how they have, for lack of a better way to put it, that's how they've been conditioned to work. And I think that it's easier to bring on those people on a part-time basis who are doing contracting full-time because they're used to being treated like a contractor.
Yeah, I can't underscore this enough. A, someone who's used to working remotely, and B, who's not working around another full-time job or a full-time job and contracting for you nights and weekends. I've never had that work out. Ever. Every time their job takes precedent and they only have a few hours a week to do it and they get behind on stuff and they're just trying to fit you in around other things and it doesn't work. So I would never, I mean, that's one of the early things I ask now when I go to hire is, are you currently doing this full time or do you have a full time job? Because it's an absolute non-starter. And I mean, I think at this point, if I were to find someone who was really good and I wanted to hire and they had a full-time job, I would consider trying to have them leave the job and come on with us. But in the early days, you can't do that because you might only have 3, 4, 5 hours a week where they can work for you. So try to find people who are full-time contracting. You know, and Upwork's a decent place to do this because there are a lot of people that are taking that stance.
The other advantage of hiring people part-time is that you can generally afford them a little bit better. You can hire experts and you can get them for a few hours of their time. And as Rob said earlier, you may not be able to get the best person in the world, but you may be able to get somebody who has comparable skills to yours or even better and at a price that isn't going to break the bank. If you try to hire those people full time, chances are really good. You just simply can't afford them and it's because of your budget. The other thing that hiring part time allows you to do is it allows you to practice being a manager. And I think that just like hiring, being a manager is a learned skill and you need to be able to practice that in order to get better at it, because if you're not a good manager, then the results that you're getting out of people that you hire are probably also not going to be good, and it's going to be due to miscommunication issues.
Yeah, and there are pros and cons to basically hiring part-time contractors where they can their hours can flex up and down. Obviously, the pros are that you don't need to have a fixed budget, and so if work slows down or whatever, you're not paying out of pocket a fixed amount every month when you may not have that because you're bootstrapping. And then there's also the flexibility that as more work comes in, you can ramp them up pretty quickly. And especially in the early days, you don't have to worry necessarily about, let's say, career advancement and annual reviews and all the stuff dealing with like taxes and healthcare. There's a time for that. There's a time where that's worth it. But in the early days, when you're just trying to get a business off the ground, it's just so much to worry about. Now, the cons of this are that it depends on the specifics, but if you can actually find someone comparable who is willing to work for you as a full-time employee in the U.S. It's called W-2. There are some advantages to that. One is that overall, it'll probably be less expensive if you actually keep them busy full-time, because contractors tend to have a premium that they put on their pricing. And another advantage is there's a loyalty thing, right? It's like people who work for you tend to get more involved, tend to care more about the outcome, and they're going to tend to stick around longer. And so those are kind of the major things to think about when you're comparing, should I hire contractors or should I hire W-2 employees? I think that, as we said, in the early days, by necessity, you're going to want to stick with contractors as long as you can. You know, long term, it is tough to grow a huge business solely with contractors. I know a few people have done it, but most of the time, getting that loyalty and that team camaraderie really only comes with a group of full-time employees.
So to kick us off on the side of full-time employees, I think that one of the important things is that you need to hire before you have a particular need for something. So if you wait until the last second, and let's say that you're working on something and you need a Facebook ads expert, and you say, okay, well, I want to kick that off in a couple of weeks, and you wait around and you don't go through a hiring process, and then it comes time and you say, okay, now I need to hire somebody because I need somebody by the end of this week. And it can be really challenging to get those people lined up for interviews in advance and go through the hiring process if you don't do that in advance. So make sure that you are hiring before you actually need somebody to get started on that work. And it sounds, I think, obvious, but I also think that it's very easy to underestimate how long that hiring process can take in some cases.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a balance here. If you have a lot of money in the bank, if you're funded, then hiring before the need, hiring well ahead of the need is what people do, right? They hire months ahead because they know they're going to be scaling up. If you're tighter on cash, I think hiring before the need, like you said, which is really just weeks in advance, it's kind of like looking out 30 days, realizing it's going to take you a month to hire. I think that's perfectly acceptable. But I think that as a cash constrained startup or business, I don't know if it's as much as hiring before the need or it's as much as hire when it's really painful, right? Because as a founder, you're going to be taking up the slack with anything. And so as you feel stuff start to just get piled and piled on top of you, hire before it breaks you. Maybe that's like hire before it completely derails what you're doing. And I think looking out 2 to 4 weeks on what is going to be breaking you soon is probably the way that I think you have to do it in the early days.
Yeah, I think Peldy ran his business, Balsamic, and to the point where he decided to hire when he felt like he was going to die because of all the work. So that was really kind of the main point. But making sure that you have things lined up so that you can put a full-time offer in front of somebody if they're the right fit, I think that it's important to always be looking. Doesn't necessarily mean that you need to make an offer to everybody, but at the same time, you also need to be aware that that process can take a while. And if it's a full-time hire, then chances are really good that they're probably going to give 2 weeks notice to their existing employer, and you may need to not necessarily coach them, but be cognizant of the fact that they may use that as a negotiating tactic, or their existing company may use that to say, oh, well, let me give you more money to keep you.
Yeah, and to give you an idea, I think some of the fastest hires that we've done in the past couple of years have been about 2 weeks from posting a job to having someone start working, and that's when they didn't have another job already going on. And the longest one was probably 3 months, maybe 4, from the time we posted, and we had to post it multiple times, and that was for a senior Rails developer, and we were very picky about that. We wanted some very specific skill sets, and we actually looked local first, and when we couldn't find anyone, then we went remote. So it was a drawn-out process. And it was actually over the Christmas and I think the Thanksgiving holiday as well. So that extended it even further. But that gives you an idea of kind of the range when looking for someone. Another point that we want to talk about is not to rule out remote workers. Obviously, there's a movement of working remotely, and 37 Signals talks about this in their book and all that. And there's definitely value in being able to find the best people anywhere in the world, right? No matter where they live. And so I think there's a balancing act here, because what we found, you know, I was totally remote for years when I had all the contractors. No one ever lived in the same city. And then as soon as Derek and I started working together in the same city here in Fresno, it made me realize just how valuable that FaceTime can be and the advantages of it. And so I don't think that either one is the best. Like, everyone going into an office 5 days a week is not optimal either, because of the interruptions and just all the overhead involved with that. I don't think being totally remote is the best either. The optimal approach we found is to actually have an office where all of us are in it 2 days a week. So we tend to go in Tuesday, Thursdays, and then other people go in as needed and they have a space where they can work. So all that said, like, I think the hybrid approach personally is something that I would love to have. I'd love to have everybody local, but only meet a couple days a week so that you can go home into your home office and actually get all the work done that you need to, because we stuff the meetings and there's a lot of interruption and discussion on the other days, but that's super valuable. That's when we get a lot of the hard work done.
Something else to look at when you're hiring for full-time employees is to hire for the most time-consuming tasks that you're already doing first. And this is an effort to essentially offload those things. And it kind of goes back to what we had talked about earlier. And you'd pointed out that one of your recommendations for people is to hire for support first. And it's because it's so time-consuming. And if there are other things that are time-consuming for you, regardless of whether they're really driving the business forward a lot or just a little bit. The fact of the matter is that if they're taking up a lot of your time, chances are good that there's probably other areas of the business that you could be spending that valuable time on. And it's probably best to be hiring for those positions first, assuming that you can afford it.
Another thing when you're hiring for full time is, if you can, like I said earlier, try to hire people who are experienced, especially if you have the budget. It's tough to burden yourself with intense training, like hiring interns in the early days. I know they can work out. I've heard of them working out. I've never been able to justify spending the time to train someone who truly is intern level. It's so much work. And in the early days of your business, you don't have a lot of time. Like, time is such a limited factor. And with that in mind, I mean, you want to look for people who can actually show accomplishments, right? They're not just talking about experience. You don't just read it on a resume, but in what way can they show you? So if they're a developer, can they show you source code? If they're a designer, can they show you past designs? If they're going to do email support, can you do a short test where you send them 3 questions about your app? You have them look through and, you know, figure out how they would respond to it. You want to be able to see, you know, what people have done in the past, not just who they have worked for and for how long.
And that's one of the dangers of hiring, is just in general that usually their previous experience and the things that they've done on a day-to-day basis, your ability to see into that can be somewhat limited. So you essentially have elevated the risk by not being able to see their work. And that's why I think why a lot of companies like the fact that there are developers out there who have public GitHub repositories and they can go take a look at their source code. And then you have Stack Overflow where you've got, you know, people's reputation on there and you can see questions they've answered and how they talk to people and how they answer deeply technical questions. And that's extremely valuable from a hiring standpoint, because you get that visibility. You get to see stuff versus you get a resume and everything looks great. There's no red flags, but you don't necessarily see any really good strengths either. So, you know, that's one of the downsides of going through a hiring process and not being able to see any specific work that they've done. And I think that kind of brings me to another point about when you are hiring, look specifically for the strengths of people, not just a lack of weaknesses. And that's, I think, a very easy trap to fall into.
Another thing to keep in mind is finding really good hires. They typically aren't looking for jobs. They're hard to find. And so typically when we're going to hire, I think through, who do I know who knows someone who would be a perfect fit for this? And referrals and recommendations using your network are the best channel, in my opinion, because A, it's going to shortcut the process, but B, that's where you're going to find the best people. You have to be careful. I rarely think of who do I know who I could hire for this, because I don't like hiring close friends and family, because that, I've seen it happen and I've seen it just train wreck businesses. I've seen it train wreck relationships. So my personal stance is like not to hire friends and family, but to hire friends of friends or colleagues of friends or folks that your network knows that you don't have strong ties to. Because having a dual relationship where you're both a friend and a coworker, or both family and a coworker, makes things way more complicated than I think they need to be.
And the last item on our list essentially relates to paying for this. And I think when you go to hire somebody, you make a full-time offer, you need to think about how you're going to pay them and whether you're going to use a payroll provider of some kind. If you have access to Gusto, which is formerly Zen Payroll, I would highly recommend that. But it does vary state to state or country to country. But any larger payroll provider should be able to provide those services for you. And then in addition to that, you're probably going to need to offer some sort of benefits, like like health insurance and dental and things like that. And those things add up. They can be really costly in addition to the cost of paying for the person's payroll. And most people don't realize this, but you also, like in the United States, you also end up paying employment taxes, which adds even more on top of that. So you can kind of count on adding anywhere from 25 to 50% of the cost of an employee on top of what it is that you make them an offer for. So if it's, you make somebody an offer for $40,000 a year, it could be up to $60,000 or potentially even more, depending on where you live and what sorts of benefits you're offering. So again, this comes down to, in some senses, risk tolerance. Like, can you afford that? Can your business afford that? You need the business to be able to support those employees long term. So the revenue has to be there as well. And I think that's where this hiring process becomes such a challenge, because until you get to that point where the business is making enough money to be able to, I'll say, quote unquote, easily hire somebody, or at least easily be able to afford to hire someone, you might be riding the business a little bit on kind of a razor's edge in some cases. And if, you know, let's say the economy goes through a downturn that you didn't expect and your business starts to go down, you could be in a position where you hire somebody and then 3 months, 6 months later, you look at your finances and say, you know what, we really can't afford this anymore. And firing somebody after they've only been working for you for a few weeks or a few months is very difficult to do, because it's not like it was a performance issue. It's just, you know, you made a wrong decision. And I think that that's more difficult for most founders to accept, because they're the ones who are at fault. It's not the employee. It's not as if the employee made a mistake or is not pulling their weight or doing the job. It's you made a mistake in the business and you screwed up.
Yeah, I think in terms of the benefits, you know, you mentioned that, that'd be something else. Is I know a lot of early stage startups, I mean, when you're below five employees, that they don't offer healthcare, because it is such an administrative, not only an expense, but it's just a big time suck to get that going. And so that's something to think about, is you obviously want to take care of your employees as soon as you can, but it's something to think about that it's not necessarily a need, and it can negatively impact your business if you try to compete with the big boys and get a 401k out and you're under 10 employees and get healthcare for everyone when you're under five employees, is something to kind of weigh and think about, both in terms of the cost and the time. And I think what you just said about risk tolerance and having either the cash in the bank or the MRR coming in to cover is something not to be taken lightly, because having to lay somebody off after you've done all the work of hiring them it would feel terrible, and it would be a very stressful decision that you'd have to make. The nice part about if you do have a recurring revenue business rather than one-time sales is that that revenue tends to be more stable. So definitely a plus of the SaaS or the membership model. So I think that wraps us up for the day. If you have a question, you can call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.